This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from the region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, the coalition's proposal for nuclear power is setting off alarm bells in the Pacific region. And Kava's a traditional brew, but in Tonga, it's undergoing a modern revival. We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, Frank Bainimarama, the one-time military strongman and former leader of Fiji, has been found guilty of attempting to pervert the course of justice by the country's high court. The court overturned an earlier ruling that found him not guilty. It said that the magistrate involved had erred in law. Found guilty alongside Bainimarama was suspended police commissioner Siti Vinigilihau on the charge of abuse of office. Though the charges are different, they both relate to the men's effort to halt an investigation into a complaint of financial mismanagement at the University of South Pacific in 2019. The ABC's reporter in Fiji, Lida Movono, has been covering the case.
State prosecutors had, towards the end of last year, filed 8 grounds of appeals on the opinion that Magistrate Seni Puomo, who had found the two men not guilty, had actually made legal errors based on evidence and procedure, and that it resulted in an unfair trial and an incorrect verdict. And Acting Chief Justice Tali Sitemo today agreed with 5 of those reasons, and he overturned the acquittal. Magistrate Seni Puomo had acquitted of the two men in October of 2023. And so now the case has been sent back to the magistrate's court, where the conviction will now be recorded on Monday and a sentence handed down in about 2 weeks.
And so what reasons did the judge in the High Court have for convicting the men?
Justice Sali Sitemo ruled that Magistrate Seni Puomo had made errors in law in 8 different ways, but chief amongst them is that she didn't apply legal precedent properly in her final ruling, and that she hadn't given state prosecutors the opportunity to challenge the defense responses to particular key witnesses. So Justice Temo ruled that Magistrate Puomo had arrived at several conclusions about those key witnesses without any evidence to support her findings, Liam.
And you touched on it before, but what happens from here?
Well, now the defense team will have to file mitigation submissions. So on Monday, this conviction will be recorded in the magistrate's court, and each of the two defense lawyers will file mitigation submissions on behalf of the two men, basically asking the magistrate to be lenient in her sentence. So what we understand right now, that it will be Magistrate Seni Puomo again who will preside over the resulting part of this case. And so she will hear the submissions, and she will also hand down sentence on the 28th of March. Now, Bainimarama faces a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison for the charge of attempting to avert the course of justice, while Siti Vinigilihau faces up to 10 years in prison. The two men will receive their sentence on March 28th, Liam, and that's just before the Easter weekend.
How significant is this verdict in Fijian political history?
Oh, this is pretty significant, Liam. And given that we had a new director of public prosecutions, you know, not too long into the case earlier, there's bound to be some response from the public. It's still early right now, so we haven't been able to record reactions from people and responses from people. But this is definitely going to make the headlines in Fiji, considering that Frank Bainimarama is facing at least 2 other charges.
That's right. This is not the end of the legal road for him, so to speak.
It's not, Liam. He faces at least 2 similar charges, one for abuse of office and another one similar to that for allegedly changing the rules on government, on the awarding of government tenders. That's the freshest of the charges that he faces. And so there's still a long way to go right now for Frank Bainimarama.
That was the ABC's Lida Movono, and he was speaking there to Liam Fox. Australia's opposition is championing nuclear power as the best way for the country to reduce reliance on fossil fuel and to promote clean energy. While the drive towards clean energy has been welcomed in the Pacific, the alternative choice of nuclear power is certainly raising concerns. Dubravka Volodya takes a look at the reactions from the Pacific.
The relationship with nuclear technology in the Pacific region is a difficult and oftentimes tragic one.
Now but 5 seconds to go, and...
Between 1946 and 1958, the United States detonated 24 nuclear bombs around Bikini Islands in the Marshall Islands.
Equal to a discharge of 60,000 depth charges, each weighing 600 pounds, strikes the gears of the...
Alison Killen from the country's National Nuclear Commission says the effects are still being felt by his community.
We got relocated from our small islands for the good of mankind, to stop all the wars in the world. Of course, the results is we were forced to move out. We were relocated from it. We're not going back anytime soon. We're homeless. For the good of mankind.
Mr. Kellen says while weapons tests differ from energy generation, it's still the same nuclear fission technology.
Nuclear is nuclear. And maybe there are ideas that will be on the table to explain the safest way to go. But there's really nothing in the world that you can say that they are 100% safe.
Following a series of nuclear weapons tests, Pacific countries came together in 1985 to create a nuclear-free weapons zone through the Treaty of Rarotonga. A feature of the treaty is keeping the region free of pollution by radioactive waste and material. Paul Barker from the Papua New Guinean think tank, the National Research Institute, says understandably, nuclear technology is a sensitive issue in the region.
The Pacific has been a region where a lot of the nuclear testing over the generations has occurred in different atolls, including by the United States, by the French in Mururoa Atoll over the years. And so the Pacific Islands have taken a strong and concerted position over the years of seeking to retain the Pacific region as a nuclear-free zone.
There are many countries around the world that use nuclear technology without major problems. The world's last nuclear disaster happened at the Fukushima power plant about a decade ago. That disaster was caused after an earthquake and tsunami. Nuclear energy is also seen as an alternative to fossil fuels, which could help countries in their transition to net zero. But Drew Slatter, a Pacific climate warrior from the organization 350.org, says it's a concerning proposal.
Nuclear energy, it's a dangerous distraction from the need to scale up genuine, safe and just renewable energy. We have a long, painful history with the shortfalls of nuclear power, so this is extremely concerning, the proposals to install nuclear reactors in our backyard in Australia. Japan themselves will observe 13 years since the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. When nuclear goes wrong, it goes very wrong.
Mr. Barker says it could take Australia years to establish nuclear power plants. And with climate change already affecting Pacific nations, he says it's an issue that could impact the whole region.
Of course, it would take Australia a very long time to actually install such power plants. They're incredibly capital intensive. So it's not going to make a lot of difference in terms of cleaning up energy and emissions from coal-fired power stations for a long time if the aim was to replace coal with nuclear.
That was Paul Barker from the Institute of National Affairs in Papua New Guinea, ending that report from Dubravka Volodya. The number of HIV/AIDS cases in Fiji has more than doubled over a one-year period, with the health minister warning of an uphill battle. Dr. Antonio Lalambalavu told Parliament that case numbers jumped from 245 in 2022 to more than 415 last year. He says Fiji is now only second to the Philippines in the Asia-Pacific region when it comes to new HIV infections.
Out of these, 404 are adults, while 11 cases are children. 3 of the children got HIV through sexual transmission, while 8 children got HIV/AIDS through mother-to-child transmission. Of the total number of patients diagnosed, 288 are reported to be males, 122 females, 4 transgenders. In addition, 31 of these cases were teenagers between ages of 15 to 19. The increase is attributed through increase in active case finding within the Ministry of Health and Medical Services using point-of-care testing. Unfortunately, in 2023 alone, Fiji lost 82 lives to HIV, which is one too many. According to the Global AIDS Monitoring Report, Fiji is now one of the top 2 countries in the Asia-Pacific region with rapidly rising new HIV infections.
That was Health Minister Dr. Antonio Lalambalavu speaking in Fiji's parliament earlier this week. It's a long-held tradition in Tonga that kava is drunk by men and served by women. Though some Tongans still hold on to these traditions, today that's changing, and a new business serving kava on tap is helping drive the change. The ABC's Tonga reporter, Marian Kupu, with more.
Born and raised in Nuku'alofa, Mele Toli remembers the old days, a time when drinking kava was a way for men to socialize, with a Tongan girl usually serving, but those days may be over.
Kava is cheaper when comparing it to when I drink alcohol. I can have a civil conversation. When I compare it to drinking alcohol, there's always a problem, but when I'm here drinking kava, I can drink and then go home with no trouble.
Mele Toli regularly joins her male colleagues around a bowl of kava to end the week. And when the ABC joined them, Va'etu Itonga, an elderly citizen, also joined the kava circle.
It's important for me to see the girls out here in this gathering. We respect and adore them, as they are now able to drink the kava together with us in this space.
And now in Tonga, kava is being sold on tab at nightclubs. Trisha Amberson, a half-Tongan and owner of Reload Bar that sells kava, says the move simply makes kava more accessible to everyone.
We can't stay paused in time. We can respect history, we can respect traditions, but, you know, the whole world is changing. And I think we are adapting to that, you know, where people have choices and, you know, I believe in making things available to everybody.
She says selling kava at the club was initially for tourists, but she says it's also let Tongans have the opportunity to try it. And although it's still an introductory offer, they're also adding sparkling to the kava to make it more drinkable.
And we have noticed that aside from when the cruise ships come in, we've had a lot of tourists that want to try it. You know, that was very surprising. We have a feedback form there that they can fill out to give us the feedback on what they think of it, you know, with their demographic, etc. But we also have a lot of local male, both male and female Tongans that are coming in now and drinking the kava.
But not everyone is on board with the change.
I did not know Tongan girls drink kava. It's their choices and freedom. But for me, their value as a Tongan woman is not the same.
Adi Basematavi is a daughter of nobility who holds the kava and customs. Kava plays a traditional role in Tonga when bestowing a chiefly title or a new king. It also serves as a symbol of important role and duties. And Adi Basemata believes Tongan women should remain in their traditional roles.
Women serves the kava or mixes the kava. The rest of the work are done by men, like that of our clan Dahangata, the Princess Latu Fuitbeka. We formed a traditional kava ceremony at the king's coronation.
My main point is women mixes the kava and serves the kava.
But Mele says otherwise. She sees herself drinking kava as a safe space for social gatherings.
During the kava sessions, I don't feel disrespected at all. The men still treat me with respect because I'm a woman.
And that story from Nuku'alofa in Tonga was from Marion Kupu. In Samoa, preparations are ramping up for one of the biggest events in its history, with the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting set to take place in the capital Apia this October. With thousands of delegates and even King Charles of England expected to attend, Samoa's government has redirected millions to ensure the historic event runs smoothly. And the Prime Minister is optimistic about the country's readiness. The ABC's Samoa reporter Adele Fruin with more.
For Walo Harris-Schuster, Samoa's Minister of Police, Prisons and Corrections Services, is just one of thousands of Samoans getting ready.
I'm looking at it from a small island perspective. I see it as a huge opportunity for the world to see Samoa, and it's also a huge opportunity for us to market ourselves, that Samoa is an excellent destination to come and visit. It's a huge challenge. I have no doubt that we as a country will all rise to the occasion.
In October, just 7 months away, leaders of 56 nations, such as Australia and New Zealand, are anticipated to descend on Apia. Thousands for a very big meeting. It's commonly known as JOCOM, or more formally, the Commonwealth Heads of Government Meeting, aimed at upholding human rights, democracy, and the rule of law in Commonwealth nations. It will be conducted around the theme One Resilient Common Future, Transforming Our Commonwealth. And although the King recently announced a cancer diagnosis, Samoa's still preparing to host the monarchs, King Charles and Queen Camilla.
And all arrangements are being made to ensure that the monarch will be protected and the standard of protection will be up to the standard they're used to in Great Britain.
Mr. Schuster says Samoa police have initiated discussions with neighbouring Pacific Islands to assist with maintaining safety and security if the need arises.
New Zealand has offered 150 police officers if needed, and similarly Australia has done the same thing. We also have our cousins from American Samoa. They have also offered to bring officers if needed. And similarly, the other countries of the Pacific.
It's such a big event. Even Samoa's teachers are being brought in to help. Samoa's Ministry of Education CEO, Iau Chris Hazelman, says that they will assist the Ministry of Police during JOCOM.
In the past, especially with the Pacific Games and so forth, the Ministry of Education has always helped the Ministry of Police, especially in areas of auxiliary, being an added number there. So we have given over 300 teachers, the names of 300 teachers, to the Ministry of Police.
Samoan students will also be involved during the meeting.
Because JOCOM will also have side events. And therefore, we have already planned that working in collaboration with the Tourism Authority, where we will have, some schools and students and, to be part of entertainment.
Mr. Hazelman says their preparations for JOCOM started last year to ensure the students' academic journey will not be disrupted.
The JOCOM will actually be taking place from the 21st to the 25th of October. Now, those are usually, during a normal school calendar, that's around the time that we usually have our primary national assessments for primary level. And therefore, for this year, the exams will take place much, much earlier, which is almost 2 weeks earlier.
And despite the magnitude of the event, the Samoan people have embraced it with immense support. In a recent press conference, Prime Minister Fiamena Mimutaafa revealed New Zealand will assist Samoa's preparations, including funding support that will allow Samoa to bring in a cruise ship for accommodation. Prime Minister Fiamena also assured that her nation will give the event its own special flavour.
I'm very confident. I'm a Pacific Islander. We're used to hosting, but we will host people in the Pacific way.
That was Samoa's Prime Minister Fiame Naomi Mataafa ending that report from Adele Fruin. For tourists visiting Fiji's numerous resorts, entertainment often comes in the form of cultural dancing. One dancer, Navi Fong, does things a little differently, and he recently received a major tourism award, the first entertainer to do so. But as our reporter in Fiji, Lethe Mavona, discovered, some Fijians are not a fan of his style.
Navi Fong has been dancing since he was 17 years old. Now 30, he has been around the world representing Fiji's culture in the form of dance. And earlier this month was one of his proudest moments.
And then when I found out that, I had been awarded that, the Rising Star Award, it was very, I was very shocked at first, and then just feeling quite very grateful.
Navi is the creative director at the Vo Dance Company, overseeing 40 dancers who entertain guests at Fiji's resorts. They also travel the world, going as far as Uzbekistan to promote Fiji abroad. It is part of the Fiji travel experience, yet he is the first manager from the entertainment industry to receive a Fiji Excellence in Tourism Award, a fact that he is proud of.
And it was just lovely to feel like many decades of work, we were finally seeing a shift in the perspective at a national level of what the value of creative arts is within something like tourism, the value of creative arts to the economy, creative and cultural industries. Yeah. Finally, we're starting to understand how we're so, as artists, we're very intricately and purposefully like interwoven into the fabric of what it means to be of service to people who come to Fiji seeking out a memorable experience with their families or with each other.
Navi operates from a stage performance facility just outside Ndenerau Island, Fiji's main tourist hub. Trained and proficient in several genres of dance, Navi's specialty is a style he refers to as fusion. While it has grown from strength to strength, the company established by Sachiko Soro is not welcomed by everyone. It is often criticized for not portraying authentic indigenous Fijian culture, a trait Navi defends.
Something that we have been able to pride ourselves on for a long time as well. We think of things from the audience perspective always. And that is why we tend to be able to draw in a good audience, is because when we are creating, we are thinking about what the audience needs from this performance. Like, what is the why? Why are they going to come and attend this? What is the deep, fundamental impetus for them having come to watch a show? Was it to be entertained? How can we entertain them? Why do they need to be entertained? Those are sort of the things we ask ourselves, as opposed to what would I like to say? I feel that at one point in our evolution as a company, that was our point of view. We wanted to create things that were true to us and us and us and us. After a couple of years, we decided to just shift that outwards and think about what can we offer people that they may need for themselves.
Navi believes that while technical ability is important, there is a unique spirit in the way Fijians and other Pacific Islanders dance that will continue to draw crowds.
100%, in my very humble opinion, but my very strong opinion, I really feel that the Fijian performing arts and Fijian culture has an unmistakable and very vehement sort of spirit about it. You know, there is a magic in the way Fijian performers are able to embody intention on, whether that be on stage or elsewhere. There is a difference in the way the presence and what we call mana, you know, here in the Pacific. It is recognizable throughout the world wherever you go, and it is always something that is commented on.
Dancer Navi Fong ending that report from Lethe Mavono. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nations.